Welcome to HN Pod, your daily deep dive into the top stories and most fascinating discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Today is episode 374, covering the top stories from yesterday, April 22nd, 2026. We have a really great lineup for you today.
We absolutely do. We are looking at a startup building brand new, completely dumb tractors to fight back against John Deere, an incredibly nostalgic Windows 9X subsystem for Linux, and a flagship 27 billion parameter dense AI model from Qwen.
Plus, we will break down a massive privacy vulnerability in Firefox and Tor, and finally, how Apple just patched a bug that let law enforcement extract deleted signal messages.
Let us kick things off with our top story, which grabbed nearly 1,500 points. An Alberta startup called Ursa Ag is selling no-tech tractors for half the price of the big brands. They are basically taking remanufactured 1990s Cummins diesel engines and putting them in brand new bodies with zero electronics.
Right. No touchscreens, no engine control units, no proprietary software handshakes. They're using the 12-valve Cummins engine, which is legendary because almost anyone with a wrench can fix it. They're selling the 150-horsepower model for around $95,000, which is a fraction of what a comparable modern John Deere would cost.
And this is a direct response to the whole right-to-repair battle. Farmers have been so frustrated with having to wait days for an authorized technician to show up with a laptop just to diagnose a fuel issue. During harvest, that downtime is incredibly expensive. Ursa Ag got 400 inquiries from American farmers just from one interview.
The Hacker News comments on this were fantastic. It turned into a huge nostalgia trip for people who grew up on farms. A user named Autumn Charnock shared this great story about driving a 1970s Massey Ferguson 135. He said it had no fancy tech, the fuel gauge was broken so you just looked in the tank, and if you lost the key, you could just reach behind the dashboard and hotwire it.
I loved that comment. He also mentioned how heavy the clutch was, which sparked a whole technical side discussion. Someone explained that to deliver high torque without complex modern hydraulics, those old clutch plates had to be pressed together incredibly hard, so pushing the pedal was a real workout.
Yeah, and the comments also took a serious turn when talking about the power takeoff, or PTO shaft. That is the spinning shaft on the back of the tractor that drives attachments. Someone mentioned how rural kids get the fear of God put into them about the PTO shaft because it is so dangerous. It was a really interesting reflection on the difference between rural and urban childhoods, and how kids on farms are expected to handle life or death machinery at a very young age.
Speaking of nostalgia, our next story is a fun one. It was a short Mastodon post about a Windows 9X subsystem for Linux. It is exactly what it sounds like, a retro throwback to running classic Windows environments.
It really brought the old school Windows and Linux veterans out of the woodwork in the comments. Before we had the modern Windows subsystem for Linux, or WSL, people had to jump through some serious hoops to get Linux tools running on Windows.
Exactly. The thread immediately devolved into reminiscing about Cygwin, Colinux, and Flinix. Cygwin was released way back in 1995, and it was basically a lightweight DLL that let you run native POSIX binaries on Windows. But as the commenters pointed out, it led to the infamous DLL hell.
Oh, DLL hell. One commenter brought up how you would have different applications porting their own versions of the Cygwin DLL and they would just clobber each other. But the biggest technical bottleneck people remembered was the slow process forking.
Right. A user named DSPLLET gave a great breakdown of why that happens. Starting up and tearing down a process on Windows is fundamentally much more resource intensive than on Linux. Windows does a lot more by default, hooking into GUI libraries and such, which is why threaded development became much more popular on Windows than relying on process forking.
It is just a great reminder of how far we have come. Now we just fire up WSL2 and have a full Linux kernel running alongside Windows with almost zero friction. But those early days of hacking together a POSIX environment on Windows 95 really built character.
Moving on to AI. Qwen just released Qwen 3.6.27b, which they are calling a flagship-level coding model in a 27 billion parameter dense architecture.
The fact that it is a dense model is super interesting. We have seen such a massive trend toward mixture of experts models lately, where only parts of the network activate at a time. But Qwen is proving there is still a lot of juice left in dense architectures. And at 27 billion parameters, it is a really sweet spot for running locally.
Simon Willison, who is a staple in the Hacker News AI community, chimed in with his benchmark results. He ran a 16.8 gigabyte quantized version of it on his Mac M5 Pro. It only used about 20 gigs of RAM, and he was getting over 25 tokens per second, which is incredibly solid for local generation.
But Sarah, we have to talk about Simon's benchmark. He always asks these models to generate an SVG image of a pelican riding a bicycle, and Qwen 3.6 apparently did a fantastic job. It even drew the pelican wearing a little bow tie.
I know, but this sparked a hilarious debate in the comments about Goodhart's Law. Because Simon's blog is so influential and his pelican test is so well known, people are starting to suspect that the major AI labs are actively optimizing for it.
Right. One commenter joked about when model providers are going to start overfitting for the pelican on a bicycle test just to place well on Simon's blog. And Simon actually replied, pointing out that since Hacker News and his blog are continuously piped into training corpuses, they almost certainly are learning how to draw pelicans on bikes, even if it is unintentional.
It is a fascinating quirk of how these models learn. We are putting our own evaluations out onto the public web, and the models are eating those evaluations to get better at passing them. But regardless of the pelican conspiracy, the consensus is that 25 tokens a second for a 17 gigabyte model with this level of reasoning is a huge win for the open weight local AI scene.
Our fourth story is a pretty serious security write-up. The team at fingerprint.com found a stable Firefox identifier that could link all of a user's private Tor identities.
This is a big deal because the whole point of Tor browser and specifically its new identity feature is to completely wipe your slate clean. You are supposed to get new circuits, cleared cookies, and total unlinkability from whatever you were doing 5 minutes ago, but this bug defeated that isolation entirely.
The vulnerability was tied to the IndexedDB API. When a website asked the browser for a list of databases, Firefox was returning them in a specific order. That order was based on an internal UUID hash table that persisted for the entire lifetime of the browser process. So even if you closed all your private tabs or hit new identity in Tor, as long as the underlying Firefox process was still running, websites could use that exact same sorting order to fingerprint you.
Mozilla and the Tor project have already patched it, but the Hacker News discussion took a really interesting philosophical turn. People were quick to point out the irony that a company called fingerprint.com, whose entire business is identifying users, was the one responsibly disclosing a fingerprinting vulnerability.
Yeah, one commenter asked why they would not just keep it a secret and use it as a zero day for their own product. The company actually replied in the thread, stating they do not use vulnerabilities in their products. But that sparked a massive debate about what exactly defines a vulnerability versus just clever engineering.
Exactly. Is reading an available API field an exploit? Some users argued that if you are working around a technical countermeasure, like Firefox's anti-tracking protections, then yes, it is an exploit. Others felt that assembling readily available information is just an oversight by the browser developers.
It also brought up the classic debate about whether average users actually care about being tracked online. Some argued people just feel powerless about it, while others pointed out that if you framed digital tracking as a physical private investigator following you around all day, people would be absolutely outraged. It is a disconnect we still haven't really solved as an industry.
Our final story today is about another privacy fix, this time from Apple. TechCrunch reported that Apple just fixed a bug that allowed law enforcement to extract deleted chat messages from iPhones.
This came to light after it was revealed the FBI used forensic tools to pull deleted Signal messages from a suspect's phone. Signal is end-to-end encrypted, and the user had set the messages to auto-delete. So how did the cops get them? It turns out it was the notifications.
Right. When you get a message on Signal, a notification pops up on your screen. The text of that notification was being cached in an iOS database for up to a month, even after the original message was destroyed inside the Signal app.
Meredith Whitaker, the president of Signal, publicly called on Apple to fix this, and they just released an update that stops the OS from retaining notifications that have been marked for deletion. But the comments on Hacker News really dug into the mechanics of how push notifications work.
There is a common misconception that Apple and Google servers see the plain text of all your messages because they route the push notifications. But as several commenters clarified, that is not how privacy-focused apps do it.
Exactly. Apps like Signal do their own key management. They essentially use the Apple push notification service to send a blank wake-up ping to the device.
The device wakes up, connects directly to Signal servers, downloads the encrypted payload, and decrypts it locally on the phone before handing the plain text over to the OS to display on the lock screen.
The problem here was not the transport layer. It was the local OS caching that plain text after it was handed over for display. It is a great lesson in endpoint security. You can have the best encryption in the world while the data is in transit, but once it is rendered on the glass, you are at the mercy of the operating system's logging and caching behaviors.
It really shows how hard it is to build truly ephemeral messaging. Every layer of the stack wants to save, log, or cache data to make the user experience smoother or faster, and fighting against that default behavior is an ongoing battle.
That is so true. Well, that wraps up our coverage of yesterday's top stories. It is always fascinating to see how these highly technical details intersect with real-world privacy and farming of all things.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for tuning in to HN Pod. Be sure to check back tomorrow for another breakdown of the front page of Hacker News.
Have a great day, everyone, and happy hacking.